This episode of Remnant Radio is brought to you in part by our sponsors at Kairos Classrooms. Have you ever thought about learning a biblical language as a supplemental tool in your biblical studies? Well, Kairos Classrooms offers real classroom environments with classmates and a live instructor who can help teach you biblical languages, both Greek and Hebrew. You need to check out Kairos Classrooms today. The price for a single semester is crazy affordable for anyone, so check out the links in the description and use promo code REMNANT to get 10% off Kairos Classrooms. Check out Kairos Classrooms today. Discount code REMNANT, REMNANT, to get 10% off your semester. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the wonderful world of Remnant Radio. In this program, we've got Dr. Andrew Root with us. We're going to be talking about his book, The Church in an Age of Secular Mysticism. It's going to be an exciting program. You guys stay tuned. You are watching The Remnant Radio, a crowd-funded show where we interview pastors, teachers, historians, and theologians from different churches and denominations. My name is Joshua Lewis, and this is my co-host, Michael Roundtree. Together, we want to help you break outside of your theological echo chambers. If you're interested in learning about history, theology, or the gifts of the Spirit, this is the show for you. Guys, we got an exciting program for you today, talking about the church and how we engage with a worldview that exists all around us, secular mysticism. It's going to be an exciting program. But before we dive into the program, I want to let you know about all the different things we got going on at Remnant Radio. We've got courses, conferences, we've got Patreon videos that are going live, extra content for people who are interested in kind of diving deeper in some of our stuff. We did an episode recently on ayahuasca and psilocybin, and I interviewed a whole hour-long interview with a neuroscientist that can be found up there on Patreon. Additionally, we're going to have a live Q&A coming up very shortly. Man, I actually believe it is this Wednesday. I'm going to look at my calendar real quick. I'm pretty sure it's this Wednesday, doing a live Q&A there on Patreon right after the show from 6 to 7, 5 to 6 Central Standard Time. I was going to get there eventually. Well, guys, I want to introduce to you my host and co-host. This is host and co-host. You're not the host. I'm jumbling over my words trying to search for Patreon content. Michael Roundtree, how are you doing over there in Oklahoma City before we introduce our guest, Andrew?
Yeah, I'm doing good. I actually flew straight in from Long Beach, spoke at a couple of churches, actually spoke at Ken Fish's church on Sunday night, and then spoke at one of our CCN member churches called Gospel City Church in the Long Beach area. So that was yesterday, flew back in today and skidded into home base for this interview. So Dr. Root, make this good, make it worth it, man. No, I'm kidding. I know it's going to be a great interview talking about mysticism. And, you know, a lot of people, they think mysticism, they think of, well, a number of things. Some people think, you know, certain Hindu or Buddhist practices. They think Richard Rohr and Christ consciousness. And, sometimes they think of Christian mysticism, and Teresa of Avila and so on. What do you mean when you're talking mysticism? Actually, yeah. You know what? Before even that, tell us about yourself, and then you can answer that question.
Tell us a little about yourself, Andrew. Tell us about you, your ministry, your family, that kind of stuff. We want to hear all about your book.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me on. It's great to be with you all. So I'm sitting right now in my little monastic cell in my basement in St. Paul, Minnesota, right... We really live right next to Minneapolis, so we're right on the border of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I teach at Luther Seminary, so I've been teaching here for 19 years, actually. I know that doesn't seem believable, but it's true. I like to tell people I started when I was 12, but that's not true either. But so I do that. I write books on... Just on the practice of ministry and particularly kind of cultural analysis of this moment and try to think theologically about that and think about our time. So that's me.
Well, it's fun. These are some of my favorite intersections, Lutheran theology and mysticism. So this will be fun. Those two don't often intersect or intertwine too frequently, but you may know, Andrew, we're I would say friends with
Jordan Cooper over there at Satan Center, and really have enjoyed going through, Book of Concord, shorter, longer catechism, those kinds of things. Been a lot of fun, a lot of life-giving stuff there in Luther's writings. So tell us about mysticism, but tell us about secular mysticism as well. I think Roundtree was kind of setting that up. There's a lot of people who have different concepts in their head when they hear the word mysticism. Some think New Age, Eastern religion. Others think kind of like that very modern, syncretistic Richard Rohr nonsense. Others think of the medieval period or kind of early church pseudo-Dionysius kind of thing. What do you mean when you say mystic? And then what do you mean when you say secular mystic? Because those are two phrases that are going to need to be established before we get too deep into the interview.
Yeah, and there's probably some loose ends when I'm talking about mysticism. But really what I mean is a kind of sense of the self being taken up into something, finding union in some kind of spiritual way. So I'm really just fascinated how this kind of secular age that we live in, which we probably need to unpack a little bit, what does that actually mean? That, you usually presume when you say secular that it's something without the mystical or really without spirituality, but that this is a kind of secular age where there are all sorts of a surplus of spiritualities. There are spiritualities everywhere, and individuals feel like they're on some kind of pursuit to find this kind of mystical union or to find meaning that is so full that it feels like there's a deep spiritual connection. A spiritual connection to what? They're not necessarily sure, and that's kind of what I'm trying to analyze as I write this book. But there is a sense that being spiritual is a good thing, and even having a kind of mystical union. And again, what I mean by that is just a sense that you're taken up into something full, that you find union with something. And I think what's quite interesting in our cultural moment is that union with something tends to be the self, that you feel united with yourself in some way. But there is a presumption that you're transformed, in that you're greatly transformed. It seems pretty unique in our cultural context, I think, that we have a kind of society where God is an option, but finding yourself transformed is a great good that everyone is after in one way or another.
Okay, so you mentioned that we tend to think of the secular age as being non-spiritual, and I can relate to that because I've heard many times people talking about you have the sacred, then you have the secular, the sacred, and then the secular. But it seems like there's like a sacred secular category where that mysticism and spirituality comes into play is what I hear you saying. And so my question is, how did we get here? Because when I think back, say in the 90s, nobody was talking about these kinds of things. Nobody was like, oh, we need to have mindfulness. You know, oh, have you downloaded the meditation app? Of course, we didn't have apps, but you follow me. Nobody was really going. I mean, I'm sure you had a few people who were like, yeah, I went off and talked to the Dalai Lama and came back and it changed me, but not like it is today. So what was the trajectory and trend? Like, what are the changes in culture that brought us to this place that there is actually such a thing as a sacred secular combination?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I first of all think that it's really fascinating how we got to a divide between the sacred and the secular. Like for medieval people, there was a kind of divide between what was sacred and what was profane. And by profane, they didn't mean like gross or bad. They just simply meant not used in holy activity. But for the most part, those things all kind of fit together. And this is what the philosopher Charles Taylor will talk about, a kind of world before the secular, that the West used to have societies in it during the medieval period where there was no secular, that secular really didn't exist as a kind of imagination that people had. But one of the things that really occurs when we enter into a modern period is that we start to kind of subdivide or we have a kind of imagination where there's a difference between what is public and what is private. And belief itself gets filed away as a private reality. So in some sense, you lose the mystical because belief becomes private. It happens in your own head. It's something that you consent to, that you will to, that you believe. And what is outside of you, say, even in material things, like you can understand why there would be a deep dynamic of the mystical if certain things, hence a relic, could be imbued with the divine force or an evil force. Like it just feels like the whole world has a kind of mystical quality to it. But when we start to divide a public-private dynamic and we think, well, what happens outside of us that is for the most part natural material. It can be answered certain kind of through rational forms. It can be answered through the kind of scientific method, maybe in some ways, or whatever. But we believe something more internal. Then we start to kind of, we have a different take on how this works. But the other thing that does that gets us more to the 90s is I took you very quickly back to the medieval period, then to the 90s, where the music was way better, this sense that the self holds a significant amount of weight. And I think what's happened into the 21st century that I try to tease out in this book is I think this very strange thing has arisen again, which is that guilt has become quite present in our cultural context. And I'm not sure that this is completely true, but I'm playing it out in the book as a kind of thought experiment that I just wonder when societies find themselves really wrestling with heavy forms of guilt, if mysticism doesn't kind of find itself coming back to the surface. So, you know, in Europe, the 14th century was utterly awful. You know, people were dying of the plague all over the place. There were two popes. Like, it felt like civilization was just coming undone. And you do get all of these different schools of mysticism that arise up because guilt feels really heavy. And I think one of the things that happens in the early 2000s, at the end of the 90s, early 2000s, into the first three decades of the 21st century, is guilt arrives again. And guilt becomes quite cutting and sharp. But it becomes not a guilt of we're sinners who stand before a holy God. It becomes a guilt that is really bound only in the self. That the guilt is, as an upwardly middle-class person, you've let yourself down. You could have been more. You could have done more. You could have performed yourself in a more unique, creative way, but you didn't. And there's a certain sense that you're always on a performance. You're always trying to perform. And, you know, you didn't do it. You didn't start the internet radio show, so you should feel awful about yourself because you could have been great and have done that. And so all of these kind of senses of guilt returning, our awareness that we're always in some kind of competition with other people, I think leads people to feel like they need a spirituality to cope with this. They need a spirituality to find meaning when meaning seems only individually constituted. And so you see the rise of spirituality, but it comes in the back end of modernity, so it doesn't seem in this very odd way that you need God within it, that you can somehow eject God from these certain forms of spirituality and mysticism, but still have a kind of transformational logic, but you don't necessarily need a personal God to act and move. Now, I find that problematic, but I also see it as a real cultural imagination that people have.
So this is the kind of new atheists that have kind of evolved into the prophets of our day, right? Who they see the need for the Christian ethic and deny the Christian God, right? Like, it's that kind of that inner turmoil of like, I can see the value of encountering the ineffable and something that is transcendent because I am so finite. If I always focus on what I can accomplish, what I can do, my finitude is always up in front of my face, which gives me an immense sense of guilt. I have to kind of transcend beyond that in a sense. And I think that's correct if that synopsis is off. But then also, I guess I'm interested, you in your book and kind of, as it seems just then, spoke to the secular and the mystical in your book and in this dialogue. And it seems as if you're definitely maybe critical of the secular mysticism, but mysticism as a whole, as it relates to encountering that ineffable or trying to have some kind of, I don't use too lofty of words, but some kind of existential experience with the divine. Could you maybe unpack why it would be appropriate maybe to embrace a mysticism that isn't secular mysticism?
Yeah. Well, I do at the core of my own project that I've been working in this book and in the kind of five that lead up to this is supposed to be volume six. It's supposed to be the end. We'll see if I can actually end this thing. But I really am fascinated with how the human being encounters the divine. I think that is, and what I'm really after is in the context of ministry, I think so many pastors get overtaken by all sorts of other kind of needs they think are there, like to keep their institution going, to grow their church in some way, that all of these other forces come into play that block them or distract them, I think, from the primary calling of pastoral ministry, which is really to witness to and help people into an encounter with the divine reality. And so for me, I talk about this quite often in a more Protestant way, that I think at the core is this sense of revelation. How is it that human agents encounter, that human beings encounter the very presence of a living God? How does God unveil God's self and make God's self known in this kind of cultural reality, in a late modern cultural reality, that this isn't just in itself a kind of holding on to tradition for tradition's sake, but that we need tradition to help us recognize that God lives, moves, and acts. And so how do we take on certain dispositions and certain visions and have certain communities and have life within communities where we can encounter the living God, where we can witness to that? That's really important to me. So at that level, there is a kind of sense of mysticism. If we define mysticism as an encounter with the transcendent, then that I think is really necessary that we have. And that Protestantism, as a Protestant, it becomes lost in some kind of rational exercise, or maybe just some kind of religious space that doesn't really produce any kind of sense of connection. It just becomes a kind of cultural religion, a civic religion, without the sense that God acts and God moves. So I think that there's a necessity for spirituality. I think there's a necessity for the mystical. I just find it really interesting that most people in our cultural context would affirm that, like whether they ever gone to church or not. Very few people will be offended if you say, you know, across a coffee shop, I've noticed you, and I've really noticed you're a very spiritual person. They'll be like, oh yeah, I definitely am. But if you tell those people that they are kind of bound within the creedal confessions of Christianity or maybe any other religious form, they could be deeply offended by that, but they wouldn't be offended by being spiritual. So there's something interesting that plays at that. And I think we live in a really odd time where you can be spiritual but not religious. Hence, you could be on a pursuit to have a mystical encounter, but not think you need a personal God behind it. And I find that really interesting and also very odd. And I'm worried, particularly within mainline Protestant communities, that unless we interrogate that a bit, what will end up happening even in our forms of faith life is that we'll kind of take on form these mystical or these secular forms of mysticism, like CrossFit or certain kind of wellness or meditation, that we'll presume that those are good enough and that it really isn't about encountering a personal God. It's just about, accessing the inner resources of the self. And I think there's something different at play that I want us to get at within the kind of spiritual dynamics that I think are necessary.
That's good.
Now, I'm interested in culturally just this Western hyper-individualism and its self-discovery and self-expression and self. It's almost like this Gnostic discovering the spark inside of yourself. I'm just curious, though, Western individualism and how that plays into the spiritual experiences of secular mysticism. And I'm curious too, is just like a piggyback to that question. 10 years ago, a lot of people were saying, and some still say, like Christianity is not a religion. And of course it's a relationship. So it's not a religion, it's a relationship. And of course, James chapter 1 is like pure and undefiled religion is this. And like, do you think that Christians have in any way sort of overbought into an individualistic culture that's like, hey, we're not a religion, that in some way actually lends itself toward or maybe makes itself susceptible to this highly individualistic secular mysticism?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, picking up your religious conversation, at least the kind of theologians that I find myself in dialogue, and I'm thinking here of both someone like Dietrich Bonhoeffer or Karl Barth, who in the 20th century, and particularly inside the kind of Nazification of Germany, wrote pretty strong things against religion and tried to put the gospel over and against religion, not because they didn't believe in, say, congregational life or even religious structures, but they were worried about how religion became a human construct that made human beings in control of God. And I think this is one of the good dynamics of a kind of Christian mysticism, is it is the reminder always that God is God and that God is uncontrollable. And I think particularly Karl Barth, if people know his theology, was very concerned that the kind of German cultural Christianity of the of World War One and then into World War Two had kind of turned God into their mascot for their kind of cultural games. And he wanted to remind them that religion is a human construct, but God's revelation, that's God making God's self known. And so I do have some kind of propensities that lean towards that. But where I hear what you're saying is when we sometimes refuse religion, we think that the self becomes the only proprietor of what is meaningful. And mm-hmm. I do think that we're fundamentally bound, and this is where religion is a good thing, that it's fundamentally bound in rituals of communities in practice. Mm-hmm. And that is really very necessary, I think, to commune with this God. And this could be even a critique of Christian forms of mysticism. When they become too individualistic and they're not bound in a community, then it becomes a problem. But that's really very rare. Both Basil of Caesarea and Anthony the Great from Egypt, Anthony of Alexandria, some of the two of the earliest kind of mystics, they went out into the desert. Well, Basil didn't even go out in the desert. He had a kind of urban form of monasticism. But when Anthony went out into the desert, the point was to pray for society. It wasn't a real departure or a refusal of the world as much as it was trying to pray in a way and commune with the spirit in a way that the whole society would be renewed through the prayers of the mystic. So there is something that's still bound within the world and how the world encounters the salvation of God, how the mm-hmm. world is moved into God's action. If the mystic is just about the self, then that's a problem. And I do think that it takes a certain modern reality for this to occur. And in the book, I do a lot trying to draw on Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who is this, you know, 17th century thinker, is really from Geneva, but ends up, you know, becoming the great author of Paris. And one of Rousseau's biggest impacts that I think in a lot of ways, most Americans and maybe every Western person is really a child of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, is that we presume that the human being is innocently perfect in themselves, that at the core of us, we are just perfect. You just talk about 90s music. You just need a Sarah McLachlan song or something to play in the background about how we're all innocent in and of ourselves. And that really is Jean-Jacques Rousseau's perspective. He thinks the issue is, or what screws that all up, is civilization, that we're perfect and innocent in ourselves, and then Paris. Just the backbiting of Paris gets into people's consciousness. So it really is a kind of Taylor Swift logic that everything is fine except the haters, that if there wasn't for haters, everything would be okay. And so it does have a certain presumption that the self is perfect in and of itself. It's just you get a lot of negative messages. And now you need a spirituality, you need a kind of form of mysticism, not necessarily with God, but you need a kind of spirituality, a form of wellness, a form of meditation, a form of exercise, maybe some kind of form of action that can help you get in touch with your truest self and help you perform that self in the magnificent way that is truly who you are. And it is a very much a flipping of Augustine. And Rousseau even wrote his Confessions, which he thought was the new rationalist modern Augustine's Confessions. Like
it's Neo-Pelagianism, like at its finest, yeah. Right? Like, yeah, I'm mm-hmm. I'm actually good within myself. And I so much on the Rousseauian stuff that I want to dive into. But there was another question I had on the tail end of the last thing you said. And because me and my co-host, we trade questions, I didn't get to ask it. So you had mentioned this ditch of that you're afraid that the church is going to get into integrating secular mysticism into the church, right? Like, let's like talk about this. Oh, this great mindfulness practice or whatever that the secular mystics are practicing, we're going to integrate that into our Christianity. I'm curious, do you see a ditch on the other side of the road where maybe the more fundamentalist camps within Christianity, which I think most mainlines have, you know, some sliver of that in most of us because we're creedal, you know, we hold a certain statements of, that govern our practice. Do you think that the oversaturation of spiritualism will cause the church to say, we have a holy book, we don't have a holy experience, and that we can actually run from the divine, we can run from touching the transcendental, what's beyond us, what's existential from us, because we fear spiraling into some kind of New Age practice? And how do the Christians navigate that?
Yeah, I agree absolutely with you. I think that the danger, the ugly ditch on the other side, is that you lose God's action. You lose that there is a living, speaking God who moves in the world, that the Spirit reveals that this Jesus Christ is still active, still moving, still redeeming and ministering in the world. And you end up just ossifying Christianity into, I guess, certain, I don't even want to say traditions are inside the book. You end up turning even the tradition into propositions that you have to kind of conform to. I mean, in some sense, like bullet points of beliefs that you have to correlate to. And then you do lose this personal encounter, this, and by that, I don't mean individualistic. I mean the very personhood of God encountering our own personhood and redeeming us. And so I think one of the things that I'm really, one of the ways I think that protects us from each of those ugly ditches, maybe, that I'm trying to explore in this book and want to get at, is a really, this book is really ultimately about theological anthropology. I mean, what does it mean to be a human being before God? And what's really fascinating about all these secular mysticisms and even the ugly ditches on the left or on the right is that they end up taking in a kind of Rousseauian anthropology, that the self is magnificent in and of itself. And I, you know, this is where you can hear my own theological commitments. I have a very low anthropology in the sense of a kind of more like Luther's anthropology, that believes that the self is fundamentally broken and the self needs something from far outside of it, that the resources that could save the self, that could redeem the self, that could transform the self are not within the self, that the self needs to receive a gift from outside.
It's externus.
Yes, that can renew it. And I think what ends up happening is we end up falling into either of these ugly ditches because we take on this kind of very high anthropology that says somehow we can rationalize ourselves to the right beliefs and then we're okay, or we can follow, we just take in that the self is magnificent and that with it completely innocent and can kind of perform itself out of anything, and we lose this kind of really low anthropology that makes the human being always by necessity open to a gift that is outside of the self. And I think that's where the guilt comes in, is that people feel so guilty because so much pressure has been dropped on the self to perform, to save itself, to find meaning for itself, to find purpose for itself, to find it within you, that everything you need is within you. And I think that exhausts people. It burns them out. I think this is probably a little bit, it's probably flattens things, but I think a lot of the mental health crisis that we have in our society comes from this very high Rousseauian anthropology that you are perfect as you are. And you should be able to inherit all or to accrue all these W's. And if you're taking L's, that's because, you know, you haven't optimized yourself in the right way. And I think that at the core of Christianity, at least some schools of Christianity, that we have to kind of refuse that anthropology.
Totally. I mean, that's not good news, man. If you're like, I'm divorced, I'm an alcoholic, you know, I'm failing at my job, I'm failing at family, I'm failing in every area of my interpersonal skills in life, and then someone to come along and tell you you're perfect just the way you are, that's horrifying. That's like so bad. That's completely defeating. It's like, no, I want you to tell me that God has made me to be more than this. You know, the bad news is, yes, you're falling short. The good news is that you can turn and repent, and God can do something meaningful with your life. That's great. I love that.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, you're talking about this elevated anthropology, and I'm thinking about just Christianity, and you shared with us your Lutheran convictions, but I know you would certainly agree with this, that on one hand we are corrupt sinners, and that is just kind of who we are. Sin corrupts us from head to toe, Romans chapter 3, Psalm 14, many places, right? On the other hand, we are human beings made in the image of God, which actually does crown us, in a sense, to borrow a word from Psalm 8, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You've set man over all of your created world, and so it's like, man has this elevated status and lowly status simultaneously, and so I think you would agree with that. And so where I want to go with this is the sort of current idea of man being this uber elevated status. Do you think that it was in some way rooted with like having detached itself from this Christian idea that the lowly aspect of our human nature really comes down to our brokenness before God Almighty? You take God out of the picture, and it's like you take the weight off of the bottom of a helium balloon, and it just floats up, up, up. Is there something like that that's happened that these secular folks have, and secular culture has removed God from the picture, while at the same time taking the Christian idea of image of God and inherent value of mankind, and that with God out of the picture, that's just kind of reached these beyond human, almost demigod levels? Like, would you agree with that as like a portrait of kind of how the trajectory took place, or am I just making stuff up?
No, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. Is that there's a deep sense within kind of Rousseau's own period that, you know, Voltaire said this: if we can get these priests off our backs, like if we could just get rid of the Christian tradition, then we'd never have to feel guilty again. You know, we would just be able to be these kind of magnificent selves. And I think that what we've discovered, oddly, is that that hasn't happened. That even outside of a kind of very rich kind of web of Christian civilization, of kind of direct Christian engagement, people feel a ton of guilt. And I do agree with you. I think there is this kind of sense that you lose God and you end up having a kind of higher anthropology. But it does, I think it also is a confusion of what it means to be human in certain senses. And I do think that there's something that goes back deep into the biblical tradition, that what it means to be made in God's image is to be the ones who can hear God speak and respond to God. And it means to walk with God in the kind of cool of the garden. And it does mean in some ways to continue to be God's ministers within the world. So there is a humble dynamic to this, in that to be an image bearer is to point from beyond ourselves to the image we actually bear. To be an image bearer is to say that we reflect the very God who acts and moves within the world. So to be an image bearer doesn't necessarily give us the weight of utter importance, but it points that we're supposed to witness to something greater. Mm-hmm. And when you lose that, you can blow up the importance of the self, but without the image that it reflects and without that kind of language and that kind of imagination, then you do lose the kind of otherness of God. You do lose the sense that there's something outside of us that is necessary for our kind of transformation. So in classic forms of mysticism, there is this deep sense that one is communing with something outside the self that will come and meet the self, but is outside of it. But in these secular forms, it really is the self caught in a kind of echo chamber, the self caught within itself. And it becomes its own kind of torture, I think.
And I think people might not realize, once you see it, it's hard not to see it. It's like that time, you know, that you read The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, and then you suddenly see romanticism everywhere and Freudian thought everywhere. It's like an itch you can't unscratch. Like, it's like, oh no, now it's there forever. This self-expressionism and self-determinism, like self-discovery, those two things that Rousseau really kind of pushed of selfhood. I see it in entertainment everywhere. You know, the concept of Moana, right? It's an old Disney movie, 2016. I've got it in my notes here. Hey, don't go to the sea. But I want to go to the sea. I felt called to the sea. I'm supposed to be at the sea. And the whole film is about self-actualization. And like, I'm going to be this, I'm going to be true to myself, self-discover who I really am. Luca, same kind of reverse, but roles, but reverse, right? He's in the water and he wants to be a land dweller. Very similar Little Mermaid, you know, motif there. A Spirit Untamed. It's an entire movie about a kid who lost their mom to a horrible horse accident. And the dad has like PTSD over it. Doesn't want his daughter riding horses, and she's like, nah, I'm gonna do it anyway. Again, the self-discovery, true to self, Frozen. Here are lyrics to everyone's favorite song. It's funny how some distance makes everything seem small, and that fears that once controlled me can't get to me at all. It's time to see what I can do to test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. I mean, over and over, it's hard to even pick a kids film that has been made in the last 15 or 20 years that doesn't follow this theme. That is, I'm going to break free of whatever norm is being tossed upon me, and I'm going to discover my true self. Like, I guess I have a question for people who are kind of just in the water of this. We're being kind of cooked alive as, like, you know, is it the frog inside the water, you know, slowly being boiled alive, doesn't know when to jump out. I feel like that is what's happening in culture. How do parents help their Christians have or their children have Christian worldviews when this is just pervasive everywhere?
Yeah. Well, it's really hard because it is, like you're saying, it's just everywhere. It's in the ether. I mean, my own daughter, one of the things that got me thinking about this is my own daughter, when she's probably 11 or 12, maybe 10, she had watched all those movies. Her school basically is a uber Rousseauian school in many ways. They think all the evil in the world is just because people don't recognize, you know, unique selves. And so that's the issue. It's haters. If there weren't haters, everything would be okay. But I was praying for her one night, and I prayed a very St. Augustine prayer. I said, God, would you please come and bless Maisie, and would you transform and change her, and would you make her new? God, would you come and just make Maisie new? And I said, amen. And then she looked at me in her, you know, 10, 11-year-old way, and she said, Daddy, why do I have to be changed? Aren't I just perfect the way that I am? Like, it is just, it is everywhere. And it's hard to... She's
totally depraved?
Yeah, that's right. And I just started reading Calvin to her, and she fell right to sleep. you know? And so it's everywhere. But here's the good news about it. I don't think, and I think this is partly the trap, that when these two kind of anthropologies are at play, this high anthropology, this low anthropology, I don't think the way that you actually confront it is by somehow winning a debate about it. The reality of this low anthropology is it's embedded within our experience. Like, our experiences of loss, the realities of our finitude mean that we're going to have these realities that we cannot save ourselves. The fact that we're aging, the fact that we're all dying, the fact that we wrestle with so much limit and liminality just points to the fact that we do not have the resources within us to save us. So the question is, do we have the kind of practices in our parenting? Do we have the kind of practices and spaces within our congregations where people can make confessions, where people can confess that they are in great need and find communities that minister to them out of those needs? I think one of the beautiful things about recovering a really kind of Christological or theologically kind of based mysticism is that it becomes embedded in practices of confession and surrender that you need something outside of you. And these are embedded. I mean, we have these experiences of loss and death. And so it really becomes about kind of testimonies and confessions of our need. And then it's taking on certain practices like prayer. I know it seems really pietistic to say, well, the answer to this is prayer. And, you know, to say that in a flat way, it's not, but in a really embodied lived way, it's exactly the answer to this. And what it means to pray is to put your very body in a disposition that you need something outside of you to save you, that you enter into a kind of passive state because you know your own actions and your own contemplations alone cannot move you into righteousness, that you need a gift from outside of you to come to you. So prayer becomes a passive act of opening your hands to receive something from outside of you. And so to teach our children to do that, to lead our communities to do that, is incredibly transformational. To come and confess how all your performances haven't saved you is not to shame people, but to invite them to take a deep breath and to receive a gift.
Yeah. I'm really interested in the way that you're talking about, like, everybody trying to save themselves, because I think that, you know, having been a Christian for a long time, we tend to think, yes, we need saving from hell, and we need saving from the devil, and we need saving from sin. And all of those things are true. And the secular world has no idea about those things, does not believe those things. And yet, as I hear you talking, what I hear you conveying is they're actually still seeking salvation. It's just a different kind of salvation. They're not thinking in terms of the devil and hell. They're thinking in terms of saving myself from dot, dot, dot. I'd love for you to kind of fill that in. What is the world trying to save itself from, and how does the Christian gospel speak into that?
I think ultimately at the core, what we're really saving ourselves from in a late modern epoch that we're in is really a deep sense of meaninglessness. But I think where that all kind of plays itself back to is something very Pauline, and is that the reality of that we need rescue from is the fact that we are finite creatures who are going to die. So being the kind of creatures who know we're going to die, there's always a great temptation to try to save ourselves. And so I think people feel that. They feel a deep sense of kind of meaninglessness. They're trying to rescue themselves from that meaninglessness. They're trying to find ways of substantiating the self as a way of giving themselves kind of significant forms of meaning or rescue from the realities of limit and death. I mean, I am amazed about this kind of secular world that we live in. I often say this to folks, that this is a kind of secular world where you can go a long way without thinking about God. I mean, I think all of the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, that's what a secular age really means, that you can live in this kind of world. You can live in the West without really thinking about God. You can go a long way without having to think about God, where our medieval ancestors could not imagine that was possible. I mean, to say that you could take a break from God, which you can overhear people say at coffee shops all the time, or people who grew up in mega churches who are saying, well, I took 3 years off from God before I, you know, found this new church. The fact that you can say that, it just would be absurd to our ancestors. It would be like saying you could go 3 years without air, like you were going to take a break from air or something. But the fact that you can do that points to what it means to live in this kind of secular age. Well, similarly to that, where you can go a long way in this cultural context and not think about God, you can go a long way in this cultural context, particularly as middle-class people, without thinking about your own death, without thinking about the fact that you are the kind of creature who is going to die. And yet, the truth of the matter is you can't really. You may be able to put that in the back of your mind, but you are always deeply aware of your finitude and your limit, and the potential that all the ways that you're living now, all the frameworks you have for meaning and significance, may be completely wrong. They may give you no life. So that I think there is this deep kind of existential inner reality here. It's the only reason that people go on these great journeys to find transformation, is they have a deep sense that they need to save themselves from their own finitude, that they need to make some kind of salvation for themselves. But they can only really do that without God, with the recognition or with the denial of their own death. So, you know, we are as creatures, as late modern creatures, we're incredibly good. And, you know, with all our streaming services, it's really helpful to never have to think about this sense that you're going to die. And I am amazed, reminding even church folks, like lay people in congregations, reminding them they're going to die, people get really offended, like really, really offended. They do not want to be reminded that they are going to die. And yet none of us make it out of here alive. Like we all are going to die at some point. And so I think that reality produces all sorts of anxieties that lead people to try to save themselves.
You just mentioned, go ahead.
Well, the saying in Texas was, I got one foot on the banana peel and the other in the grave. But that was all. That was my only contribution. Josh, you can go.
You interrupted me to talk about a banana peel. That is insulting. I don't even know what that means. I have no clue what the banana peel grave reference is about. Okay, there it is. There's no explanation. Okay. So, Andrew, you mentioned just a moment ago these kinds of treks people make to, you know, to somehow earn a salvation, to some kind of spiritual experience. I think it's interesting, maybe by God's providence, you know, we requested this interview many moons ago, and I think Russell Brand got baptized this week, which is an interesting figure. As an individual, right? This is a guy who, for all intents and purposes, has commoditized spiritual experiences throughout his life, whether that be sexual experiences, whether that would be use of psilocybin, DMT, those kinds of like recreational drugs, the use of yoga, these kinds of, how do I just have this kind of spiritual experience, but I've commoditized it. I've turned it into a product to be purchased. You mentioned individualism. It's kind of hard to not talk about individualism without Western capitalism, and saying all the choices that we have and purchase and those kinds of things. How does the church prevent this kind of deception, you know, where we view things as encounters with the Lord as something to be purchased? You know, I think we've got, I mean, you can make arguments on all sides of the camps, from conferences to seminaries. Like, if you want to get closer to God, you know, you here's the way to do it. Put your bottom dollar there. As a guy who runs a course and a guy who clearly has gone to seminary, you know, obviously there's a line that we're willing to walk through carefully. So could you maybe walk us through that concept of commoditizing these spiritual experiences and how that is antithetical to the Christian worldview, but then where the Christian ethic begins to step in different spaces?
Yeah, and it is, you know, it is a challenge, because, you know, capitalism is a very interesting example, because there's so many ways that it malforms us, and yet it's nearly impossible to opt out of it. You know, it's just, it's everywhere. So it's very, you know, possible. It's almost impossible to opt out of it. So you see that this is more than just a choice. These are also structures and kind of frameworks that we have to find our way through in some ways, and need certain practices to stand up against their power in other ways. But I think here's at the core of this, and one of the things I do in the middle of the book is try to mine a bunch of memoirs, because I think the memoirist in our day and age is the kind of secular mystic. Every memoir you read, and, you know, most publishers will now tell you, like, that the memoir is the form of literature of this generation, like of these last few decades. What sells is memoirs, and these become these very self-directed kind of stories, but they are always stories of people's transformation. And what I find fascinating is there's kind of two different ways that these memoirs, where there's really kind of three different buckets you could put these memoirs in. And two of them demand kind of commodification, and the other one I think is impossible to commodify. And the first one is this kind of heroic action. So one way of spirituality is to take these heroic acts. So you get these memoirs of people who decided to walk 1,000-mile path or something. And it's like facing nature, it was, in conquering it heroically, was how they found salvation. Or there's like a book about becoming a great chef in New York City, and it's all about all the sacrifices made, not for any other human being, but for the job that you knew was all about kind of how you could be magnificent. So one is this kind of deep sense of heroicism. The other is this deep sense of finding your own kind of inner genius. And this is often, like you were referencing the Disney movies earlier, the Disney movies have this high anthropology of a kind of exclusive humanism that says there's an inner artist within you, there's an inner genius within you, and if you can just find your great talent, you can escape that. And you can see how both of those can be commodified. Like the heroic action, there can be all sorts of websites that can take you on some great quest to overcome your limit. You know, like CrossFit and others become absolutely spiritualities that do this, that you can overcome your limit. Exercise itself becomes a kind of spirituality that overcomes this. And then there's also the way you could commodify your inner genius. Like if you can get in touch with your true expression, and if you can find different platforms to express your ideas, if you could really find someone who could help you produce the kind of right kind of podcast, then everyone would listen to you, and you would have audience for your magnificent self. But inside these memoirs there are these others that did not come necessarily from kind of people still in the church or anything like that, people who are kind of apologists for Christian belief. But there were these memoirs of deep loss, and particularly like memoirs of addiction, that were very different. They were not about how the self could heroically overcome or how the self could find their inner genius, but they were about how the self, throughout all their own actions, were left empty-handed. And the addict memoirs were particularly interesting, because what became the engine of transformation wasn't what the self could do, but when the self could surrender, when the self could admit that they were broken, when the self could receive the gift from outside of it of another to minister to them. And there were similar ones around kind of imminent dying, where people were going to die, and they surrendered to their death and wrote these beautiful goodbye letters to their children. And so you could see a very different anthropology at play. You also see that you can't really, I mean, it becomes much more difficult to commodify kind of spiritual pathways of surrender and confession. You know, you can even think of kind of forms of therapy that you pay for usually are ways to help you get unstuck so that you can find your kind of more magnificent self. But a confessor, someone you confess with, you don't tend to pay them. They tend to be there to give you words of forgiveness and give you practices that can restore you into communion with God and receive the gifts of God. So I do think that there are most of the spirit. I think spirituality is big business is another way to say it. But the kind of spirituality embedded in this kind of low anthropology that really is embedded in the theology of the cross, where God meets us in suffering and brokenness, it's really hard to commodify that.
Okay, so how do you see the secular mysticism that you just talked about and these various practices that you just named, how do you see this infiltrating the church or imperiling the church in some way?
Yeah. Well, I mean, people who know these books know that I draw on Charles Taylor for most of them, or Hartmut Rosa, a German sociologist. But one of the things that Taylor says that I think is really quite fascinating, he says the conflicts and dilemmas that exist in modernity are not ever two-sided. It's not usually kind of two sides teamed up against each other. It's usually triangulated. There are three sides in play. And he says you can particularly see this when you look at those who are opposed to kind of Christian belief or, you know, religion in its good form, you know, like we talked about religion in its maybe negative form, but religion in its good form, you can see this at play, because some people are kind of repulsed by religion or oppose religion because they think it's fundamentally repressive. Like it tries to tell selves that they are broken and that they're not perfect in themselves. And so it represses people. But then you discover that there's another group of people who are opposed to religion, not because they're repressive. They actually hate those exclusive humanists that say religion is repressive. They think exclusive humanism itself is a kind of castration of the heroic spirit inside. And they tend to be opposed to religion because they think that, it bowlerizes the darker parts of reality, or it cuts out the kind of more, it edits out more of the difficult parts of life. So the problem with religion is it pacifies people from having to deal and confront with, the darker realities.
It's
and
a
so
crutch.
You start to see, it's a crutch. That's a perfect way of saying it. It becomes a crutch. And you can kind of see how these two play off against each other. And at times they don't like each other, but they can both team up against religion or people who believe. And Taylor's point is that there still is, but one of the sides denies that there is anything beyond human flourishing. All life is human flourishing. Again, your Disney movies, it's really about human flourishing. So how human selves can come to know themselves so that they can flourish for themselves, whatever that might mean. There's often no more moral horizon than being happy, but that is all life is about. The other side really believes it's not about kind of this kind of exclusive human flourishing, but it's about heroic action. So they are offended by religion thinking there's something beyond death. That if you think there's something upon death, you're just using religion as a really kind of lame fairy tale that, you need a talking God to keep you from having to face the darker parts of reality. So those realities exist. And what I try to articulate in the book is that you've seen how both mainline Protestantism and evangelical Protestantism have found themselves more kind of sliding down, losing their beyonder commitments, that there's something beyond these two realities, that there's something beyond even in our mysticism, that we're trying to encounter something beyond. And we easily slide into a kind of counter-enlightenment heroic action, what it means to be a Christian is to be part of God's gym and is to, be a culture fighter or something, or it slides down to the other side where what it means to really be a Christian is to be an exclusive humanist who thinks that what's most important is that people are affirmed in their unique identity expressions. And I think Protestantism and Protestants have become more unlike each other as they've kind of slid down that triangle and found cover either in exclusive humanism or cover in kind of counter-enlightenment realities. And this sense of mysticism is, in a redeemed way, becomes all the more important because I think we do still need to hold on to something beyond human flourishing, like the kingdom of God, something beyond death, like a sense of salvation and union in God's own being. And it does lead us to have to make confessions and surrender that there is a greater story at play, that there is a the very action of God that redeems us and brings life out of death, and that we find reconciliation and renewed life in those ways. So those are the two ways I've really seen Protestantism kind of hide from maybe the kind of confessions it needs to make, and really in some sense hide from the cross by either finding cover in a certain kind of cultural heroicism or a kind of enlightened exclusive humanism.
That's great. I guess give me the Mars Hill apologetic for the secular mystics, right? So like Mars Hill, hey, this unknown God, let me tell you about him. You know, there's this big Buddhist temple in Keller, Texas, where I used to live, and we'd go out there and there'd be these, you know, monks just kind of hanging out in the garb, and you know, we'd ask them, hey man, like, what are you doing out here? And, you know, and they'd be like, oh, I'm trying to find the light. I'm trying to get one with the source beyond, and like that kind of nonsense. I'm like, hey man, I've got the light of the world. I've got that, you know, like the Mars Hill apologetics, like, you're looking for this. The gospel actually provides the source of this, right? Now, I acknowledge that there is a legit danger to a kind of seeker-sensitive movement where we try to find what people are looking for, and then we present a kind of a carnal kind of Christianity that looks like something that we're not trying to create God in their image. But I suppose, what is the true thing that the secular mystic is looking for that the gospel can really provide without compromising on the gospel? I guess that's my question. And how would you encourage Christians who are going to kind of be in this water of this worldview for a very long time? How do we engage with that apologetically?
Yeah. I mean, the best way to illustrate this is just the kind of story that I use in the book, which is being in Paris. We were in Paris in 2021, right when Paris had been open for like 2 weeks since COVID, but then they were going to kind of pull the curfew back the last day we were there. So we had these kind of thoughts that we were going to spend the night up on the Seine and, you know, like take in Paris, the city of lights, outside of curfew. And you got the feeling that whole day before it, that people were just ramped up for this, that Paris was going to come to life as the curfews for COVID were over. But we're old, so right when it became time to, you know, stay up and start drinking wine, we were like, "Eh, we're gonna go to bed. We have an early flight in the morning." But I decided I wanted to take one more look at the Pantheon that's at the Sorbonne, and so I walked up to it. And Paris was now just, people were everywhere, and there were young adults everywhere, especially around the Sorbonne, just everywhere in this. And they were all huddled up, and they were listening to music, and you could tell they were going to be there all night long as this great celebration of the curfew being over. And I walked up to the Pantheon, and to the right, there is a statue of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And there were all these young adults sitting on Jean-Jacques Rousseau's feet, and they were listening to the Bon Iver song Holocene. And if you know that Bon Iver song Holocene, or people who are listening can Google it or YouTube it and hear it. There's not really a chorus in it, but there's a refrain, and the refrain is really powerful. And it's kind of, Bon Iver is kind of mystical in his own way of doing music. But the refrain was, and all these young adults are listening to this, and they start singing this essentially into Rousseau's ear as they're sitting at a statue. And Bon Iver, Justin Vernon, the writer of the song, the refrain is, "And at once I knew I was not magnificent." And the whole song is a kind of confession of exhaustion, of trying to be magnificent, in the kind of transformational power that occurs when one stops, puts down their hands, and confesses that they are not magnificent. And I do think that resonates deeply with a certain biblical motif, that, you know, that the great psalm, "Be still and know I am God." If you look at that in the Hebrew, one way to render that text is, "Put down your hands and know I am God. Put down your hands and receive. Put down your hands and stop fighting me. Put down your hands and stop trying to accomplish something and perform something. Put down your hands, be still, and receive a gift from me." And so I think what the Mars Hill speech is this deep sense that you're exhausted. We know why. Makes sense. I feel tempted into that same kind of performative dynamic. But the real Mars Hill perspective is a very kind of Blaise Pascal one, who, not far from that Sorbonne, down the street actually from it, had this experience of great fire, had his great transformational experience where he encounters the personal God, where he says, not the God of the philosophers, but the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In other words, it can't be a mystical, it can't be a secular mysticism. It has to be the God who comes to us embodied in the very personhood of the triune God. But he has this experience where he then makes his wager. And the wager, and this is my Mars Hill assertion, is the wager is that if that you fall into your failure, if you confess your impossibility, if you confess your experiences of death and loss, the wager, and this is Pascal's wager too, is that if you'll confess those, if you'll surrender to those, if you'll stop trying to work yourself out of those or finding a new dynamic to save yourself and a new practice, a new exercise method, a new diet, if you'll confess that and fall into your despair, you will find a great presence there. You will find the very ministering Jesus Christ who will come, the very God of Israel who takes what is dead and brings life out of it, who takes and is found in barrenness and in failure, bringing new life and promises out of that barrenness. That if you do that, you will, the way my wager is that you will find a great presence there. And it will be a very different mystical experience. It will be a mystical experience that will save and renew you, but always through your confession of your impossibility. And I think that's the Mars Hill experience, to make a confession that you're not magnificent and see what you find there. And I think you'll find a great spirit coming to you in the person of Jesus Christ, who witnesses to his Father, that ministers life out of death.
You're a good Lutheran, my friend. I asked you how you do apologetics, and you responded with law and gospel. Congratulations, you passed the test. You get to keep the
dialectic
tattoo.
Dialectic is always at play. It's always at play.
That's right. That's right.
Cool. Well, I think probably be a good time to sum it up. Andrew, I'll give you just a moment to think about your answer. And I'll just share, your answer to the question of like, what's the big takeaway here? Man, I just love the way you're articulating that, like the world is seeking salvation constantly, even if they articulate it differently than Christians do, because it's built into the fabric of who we are because of our mortality, because we are finite, that I need saving, and the whole world's trying to save themselves. And we as Christians have the solution to that. We have the gospel, Jesus saves, and his gospel isn't just for someday when I die and go to heaven. His gospel is for this very day. Every day I have this sinful inclination to fall back on trying to save myself, to make myself significant, to make myself, my best self and self-discovery and all this kind of worldly nonsense that like that is in all of us. And it's just so powerful to just come back to Jesus and let Jesus save us every day. It's like this renewing of the mind that has to take place. And that's like the, I think, Christian mysticism side of it, is enter into that place of meditation, of a friendship with God, where you're rinsing your mind of lies with truth, God's truth, that Jesus saves and you can't save yourself. So anyway, I just think about that in light of, the millennial generation being labeled by a lot of people as the burnout generation. I just think that this is a really needed message. A lot of people are burning out because they're trying to do too much and be too much instead of to make much of Jesus. So there's my little thought nugget. Josh, what about you? Before we go to Andrew, you have any closing thoughts here?
Yeah, man, I think it's important that we know the kind of cultural moment that we're in. The kind of exegeting the text is super important, but exegeting the culture, knowing what the culture is, where they're at, and what message needs to be applied. There are those situations where the rich young ruler runs up to Jesus. What do I have to do to be saved? And he gives him law, right? Gives that law so that it humbles the guy so that he can receive good news and gospel. In other accounts, he's picking up the woman that's caught in the act of adultery, right? Giving her gospel, go and sin no more. Good gift of forgiveness. And knowing the kind of cultural climate, the cultural moment that you're in, I think is super important. And knowing how to engage with people who are looking for something of a spiritual encounter, I think is really important. considering we have that, like we actually have what they're looking for. You know, Jesus promised, you know, that he would give life and life more abundantly. The enemy comes to steal, kill, and destroy, and they're living in his kingdom. They're living under his rule, and all they see is death, barrenness, and destruction. But those who abide in Christ bear much fruit, right? And certainly we understand this as an internal characteristic. We understand this to be a sanctification. But I would say one of the reasons that I have been so interested in the mystical teachings of like the Desert Fathers, the medieval mystics, those kinds of things, even modern mystics like Tozer. The reason these guys are so interesting to me, I think, is because the Protestant Reformation lost a doctrine that I think is really, really important. And it's that doctrine of theosis, partaking of the divine nature. It's not just sanctification, where my morals or my ethics are changed, but like actually being a partaker of something that is divine. And I think that's something that the world is super hungry for. And I guess I would ask, as my kind of takeaway, is for the church to kind of wake up to that. What are you offering to the world? I really hope it's just not dead, sterile, dry religion, like you mentioned, propositional truths that we just yell at people. I hope we can say, you know, what John said, that which we have seen with our eyes, we've touched with our hands, we have then proclaimed to you. Is the gospel that we're preaching something that's real and tangible, or is it something ethereal and some kind of like far off fairy tale? Anyway, I would just encourage Christians to get back in touch with that kind of Christian mysticism that says we can touch the ineffable and partake of that divine nature. That would be a pursuit of mine that I would want to invite others to as well. Andrew, closing thoughts, my friend.
Yeah, my closing thoughts are to echo both your thoughts, and I really do agree with you on the theosis reality, and I happen to. You know, this checks all the boxes. That there's the kind of Finnish interpretation of Luther is actually to read Luther with a deeper sense of theosis than we often give him. That there's that what justification is a being taken up into Christ. There is an ontological union with the being of Christ. And so I do think that we have to recover a mystical reality, but that mystical reality needs to be Christological in some ways. It needs to be definitely embedded in a deep sense of a Trinitarian imagination. And we have to access it. And I think this is the most important piece from my perspective, is that we access it through the cross. And that Amen. Isn't just a kind of propositional atonement theory. It is a representation of how God acts in the world, that God acts as a minister who leads us into theosis through kenosis, like through a humility to minister to us, to free us from Egypt, to raise Jesus' dead body from death. That this is what that renews us and transforms us.
That's right. Yeah, we would use language of normative means and extraordinary means in our church, where we would say those ordinary means of grace is the institutionalized, commissioned forms of connecting with God through the preaching and teaching of God's words, the sacraments, through worship. He inhabits the praise of his people, like these kinds of means of grace. But and then these extraordinary means that he doesn't owe us, that we can't conjure up, but God sovereignly brings upon his people in these kinds of new and spontaneous and miraculous ways. So guys, thank you so much for tuning into this program. I didn't mention it earlier. I know I said there's a lot of things going on in Remnant, Patreon, all that fun stuff, courses, conferences. But if you want to stay up to date on all the things that we're doing, Remnant, including interviews just like this one, you got to subscribe to the newsletter. There's a link in the description of this video to theremnantradio.com. That's going to have a place for you to subscribe to the newsletter. We have a discount code that's coming out for the conferences. You should definitely check that out because that will be coming out, man, I think this week. So you want to make sure you get it while you can. Andrew, thank you so much for jumping on the program. And for those of you watching, we'll see you next Wednesday talking about the yogas from 4 to 5 p.m. Central Standard Time. See you then. Want to thank Kairos Classrooms for sponsoring this episode of Remnant Radio. And if you're out there, you've ever wondered, hey, I wonder if learning a biblical language would be a supplemental tool for me to help me in my biblical studies. Well, you need to check out Kairos Classrooms. They offer Greek and Hebrew classes that can help teach you and train you. It's a live classroom environment with actual students and actual live teachers, and they help teach you the biblical languages of Greek and Hebrew. And you need to check out Kairos Classrooms today. There's a link in the description, and you can use the promo code REMNANT to get 10% off. These classes are already crazy affordable, but with the promo code REMNANT, REMNANT, you'll get 10% off of Kairos Classroom. So check that out today. And thank you so much for Kairos for sponsoring this episode of Remnant Radio.